Today, we are joined by a member of the Celtics royal family. She was a two-sport athlete at the University of Hawaii and went on to have a successful design career working with titans like Kraft, JCPenney, and PepsiCo. In recent years, she started her own design firm with Bruno Lens Studios and co-founded the Casey Jones Foundation in honor of her father. So without further ado, it's an honor to welcome on the Duchess of House Jones, Brina Jones. How are we doing today?
I'm good. How are y'all doing?
Doing great. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. I love to talk sports. I'm happy to be here.
We'll have to have you on for a Thursday maybe someday so you can come get some takes off. So what kind of, I mean, obviously there's probably a very big reason on what got you into basketball, but what kind of was that like, you know, growing up, the daughter of a very, very successful and well-respected Celtics coach? And what kind of got your interest and your itch going for the game?
Oh, well, when I'm the fourth kid out of five, well, there's six kids now, but out of my mom and dad, there's five of us, and I'm number four. And my brother was number two. There's four girls and one boy with the first group. And so my brother from two had a basketball in his hand because dad didn't waste any time. But for me, I started out drawing. I was an artist and started doing art ever since I was 10 years old and avoided basketball at all costs because I saw what was going on with my brother and nobody compared my brother to my dad. Is it going to play basketball? Is it going to be this way? Is it going to be? So I was hiding. But I couldn't hide too long because I was super tall. So by the time I was tall since I was 1 year old, people thought I was 4 years old when I was only one. So I was a big kid. So by the time seventh grade came around, I finished seventh grade and my dad came to me and he said, "Now look, you're 6 feet. You're going to have to do something with your height." I was like, "Modeling, maybe?" "No, not modeling. You got to go play basketball." And I said, "Okay." So he always had a camp since we were kids. He'd had it with Steve Curley for years. And so my brother was playing this whole time and was already an awesome player. So he took me to camp and it was my beginning of my eighth grade. And I cried for the first 2 days. I didn't know what I was doing. He taught me well. He taught me how to shoot. He taught me how to do a layup. He was so patient and kind. And I was so embarrassed because it's his camp and his daughter can't play basketball worth a lick, you know? So that was my painful beginning. But after the third day, it was cool. My brother was one of the coaches and one of the refs. And so he would encourage me. By the third day, I got the bug and I loved it. And I was like, "Yeah. Ah, this is great," you know? And so I got most improved and it's a 5-day camp. So my third day I got the bug. And after the fifth day, they said I was the most improved player. And then that was it. I was knee deep into basketball. And my brother remembered and told me the other day, he remembered one of the, I went to camp after that through high school. And one of the camps, he was reffing. And a friend of mine, usually when somebody grabs the ball, it's a jump ball, but I didn't understand that concept. So I let my hands go, you know, I thought that'd be rude, you know, if I took the ball. My brother said, "No, you get that ball, you get it, you keep it." I said, "Oh, okay." So next time down the court, my friend Ann Copley, she's so sweet. We both got the ball off the rim on the rebound and she grabbed it. And I flicked the ball like this and she flew over my shoulders and hit the ground. And my brother was like, "Eat," you know, but I was excited. You know, I didn't mean to do it maliciously, but she was laughing when we were cracking up. But I really started loving the game of basketball besides watching it. I always loved watching it, but I put pressure on myself of being Casey Jones's daughter because you get that comparison like my brother already had. And then I was like, "Well, if I'm not good, you know, then, I don't want to embarrass him." And then, you know, and then I'm tall. So people expect you to be good and a ball play anyway. So that's my start into basketball. And by the time I got to, we were in seventh grade, we were in Maryland here. Then we moved to Boston, you know, when dad was already assistant coach when we were living in Maryland. And then we moved up to Boston or to Andover. And eighth grade, I was in Andover junior high and ninth grade. By the time I got to High school started in 10th grade, and I was starting on the varsity at that time, and I was starting to dunk. So it kind of, I always give the blood, it's in the blood too. So I don't get credit to my.
You ramped up quick.
Yeah, it kind of went fast. So it was good fun. And my biggest thing, or what I was known for, especially in 9th grade, was blocking shots. So I was on the all-star team on the ninth grade in Andover Junior High. I'll never get, my cousin and my brother were in the stands watching. And I had like 14 blocks that night. And I had like 5 in a row, one run. And they were like, oh, you know. But again, the girls were fun. We just had a good time. And that's where my passion for basketball started, when my dad taught me how to play.
Yeah, they started calling you Brina Russell at that point when you had 14 blocks in a game.
Yeah, that's right. Uncle Bill, he would have been proud of me if he got to see me. But yes.
So you mentioned you're an artist, and one of the things I think drew me to basketball at a young age was like the freedom of creativity, and like it's kind of like practicing art. Like you're kind of, you know, either you have it or you don't, but also you can kind of develop it. Did you feel that when you started to really get into it, the freedom of the game and like the practice being kind of like a ballet display almost?
Yes, it was like you said, a freedom of expression. And for me, it took me a while to get the fire part of it, but during it, I just loved the movement of it. I loved dad taught me left and right hooks, you know, so that was my signature move in college. But dad would say the strategy of it. And I wasn't as smart as he was in that area. I just loved, like you said, the movement of it and the timing of it and working together with your teammates. And I just love the camaraderie about it. And then everybody getting excited and helping each other out. And if you, you know, if you hit a cold spot, you know, which we all do it at some point, you know how to help out on the rebounds or defense, or you help someplace else out. But I just love that camaraderie. I love the movement, and I love the feel of jump shots, the how it rolls off your fingers and all that kind of, because I just get excited about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, most definitely. And did you guys have any, were there any like childhood battles out there on the playground? Were there any good games between you and your brothers?
Well, you know, ironically, we never played against each other.
Oh, never.
We never did. We never had a hoop at our house. Okay. But I think it's because dad was always at practice. Yeah. So dad would take us, you know, when I was really little, Casey was already like in his like 10 or something. So dad would always take him on the court and stuff. So he was already exposed to that. But at that time I was running away from basketball. So we never had that opportunity. But as we got older and when we did start playing, and he was on the varsity team for Andover and I was too, you know, we play after a practice and talk about our games and stuff like that. So that was a blessing for that, for him to be there, and during camp, because he was a ref and a coach during dad's camp too.
So would you say that he was kind of like a mentor for you, or did you have anybody else that kind of mentored you during high school other than your dad?
My brother definitely was the mentor. Yes. Dad was the overseer.
Yeah.
Because during camp, he was right there, you know, and again, he coached us just like he coached the Celtics. He was very quiet. He'd come up behind us and just start talking just like this and say, you know, if you just do this way, you might want to try that. You know, he was just very calm and laid back. And my brother was the same way. He would just say, hey, Brian, I tried doing this, or, you know, what about that? But yeah, so my brother was the number one mentor, and my dad was the overseer.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, you know, Andover's it's not an enormous high school. It's not like 4,000 kids, but it's like 2,000 kids. It's a pretty good school to be starting varsity your first year. Any sort of like big games, or did you go to like any sort of state finals or anything like that, that, you know, ring bells?
Well, in my first year, we did not go to the finals. And sadly, my first year was my last year because we moved back to Maryland because my mom and dad divorced. And my high school coach freaked out. Miss Axelrod, she was so upset. But when we were, when I was in Maryland, we went to the States. We were like one game away from the States, my high school, my senior year in Maryland. But in Andover, we were a strong team. I mean, we played Methuen, we played all Chelmsford, all Tewksbury, all kind of good stuff. And what I liked the most was all the girls are great. Every team, there's nobody any, there's no malicious players or mean players. They were all really great sportsmanship. And that's what I loved about playing there. And the same thing with Maryland. I loved it. That was, the sportsmanship was wonderful.
Nice. Yeah, I mentioned you're a two-sport athlete. Did volleyball come first, or did you pick volleyball up in high school?
I picked the volleyball in high school. I was horrible.
Like, but a fast learner as always.
Yeah, I could block easy, so that was why they got me on the team, but I was not good. But my basketball coach wanted me to stay in shape. I'm a big eater, and so he always wanted me to stay in shape and get ready for basketball. But I, in Maryland, I played in Andover, but I was not good at all. And I even quit the team at one point, and my coach, my basketball coach, had to talk me back into it. When I got to Maryland, I got better. I was a better hitter, but I still wasn't a really good player. But when I got to Hawaii, I was playing ball. I was playing college ball for the University of Hawaii. I was a Rainbow Wahine. And my trainer at the time, Lynn, she asked me to play USVBA volleyball. So USVBA is a league, is a national league, and there's college players in it. So I would play that on the weekends when you didn't have a game. So I'd play against our University of Hawaii Rainbow Wahine volleyball players and block them too. It was good fun. But they asked me to play after I finished my fourth year of playing basketball. They asked me to play my fifth year of volleyball, but I was like, my shoulders already have to have shoulder surgery, and I like to eat too much. So I just continued to play USVBA volleyball through until I was 39 years old. So I love volleyball. Yeah. But Hawaii made me a better player. They taught me the plays. Shoot threes are my favorite ones. Quick ones were awesome, but shoot threes are my favorite.
Nice. What's a shoot three? That's a volleyball term?
It's a volleyball term. It's like I was a middle blocker. And it depends on who we were playing, or if I was playing mixed with guys, I would be an outside hitter. So with an outside hitter, the guys would instead of lobbing or setting the ball high and I come and hit it, they would literally shoot it at me. And I would always have to be, they call it ahead of time. They say, they would point, you know, three. So when they would get the ball, I'd be already up in the air. So they would look for me in the air, and so that way a blocker couldn't come and block me. There'd be nobody there.
Yeah, it's like that Trae Young, Tony Parker, goofy foot, step before the typical release point layup. Okay.
That like it looks it. Like that.
That's cool. How did University of Hawaii get on your radar? If you're a D1 ball player, you probably had a couple other people on your radar asking you to come to town, but how did Hawaii win and how did they get on your radar?
Well, Hawaii, it's funny, when I was a sophomore in high school, Dartmouth was the first one that contacted the coach. And they're like, well, she's too young, so you can't do anything. And then when Dad's camp had several high school and college players that helped during the camp. And one of them was Jerry Bassone. And he, my junior year or senior year, he was like, oh, I'm going to be the coach, assistant coach for Old Dominion women's basketball. You know, do you want to go there? And, you know, he asked Dad, and Dad said, well, do you want to go? I said, sure. Cause that was like the number one place to play in the 80s for women. And so I said, yeah, that sounds good to me. No problem. And then later on, I don't know if it was the same year or the year or my senior year, he got the call from University of Hawaii, and he got the head coaching job there. And he asked me, do you want to go to Hawaii? I said, aloha, yes. Definitely, yes. And the big perk was Tom Selleck was there because Magna PI was filming. That was a draw. Wow. And so I was like, yeah, so that was it. And my uncle, I call him my uncle, they're all players that my dad played with. So Uncle Bill's, Bill Russell, Uncle Satch, Zach Sanders. So Uncle Willie Knowles, he found out that I was going to Hawaii, He called up dad and said, oh no, she's not going to Hawaii. She's going to UCLA. Yeah, because that's his school. And he lived across the street at the time from the school. So he was close by and he said, I can keep an eye on her. You know, I'd be there for her. So he told the coach, UCLA coach, and he said, how come you're not recruiting my niece over there in Massachusetts? Or no, I was in Maryland at the time. And she said, who? So he talked to my coach. They sent the tape to her and they started actively recruiting me. And then Penn State started actively recruiting me. So I had Penn State, UCLA, and Hawaii. And so my uncle said, come and do a trip down to UCLA and you'll see. And I said, okay. So I went there. They were super kind girls. I got to meet Jackie Joyner because she was on the basketball team at the time. And they said, go talk to Jackie. She's going to be in the Olympics. I said, okay, yeah, sure. You know, everybody thought I was Cheryl Miller because I had the same hair. I was the same height and the same coloring. So every time they would see me, they, hey, Cheryl. I said, no, I'm not Cheryl Miller. The school was great. My uncle was elated. He was like, please come to the school. You know, the coach told me I wouldn't start. I would be, you know, of course, because I was only a freshman when I come in. And she said, you know, we'll work you in probably your sophomore year, your junior year. I said, that sounds good. So I had a great time visiting and I was considering it. Then I didn't get to visit Penn State because somebody signed before I did. So that scholarship was gone, but me and the coach, we still had a great rapport. She was super nice. Then I got a call from Rutgers. So I went to visit Rutgers and I already saw Malibu by this time and already visited Hawaii by that time. So I was like, I think I'm gonna go towards the beach. So Rutgers was out and I ended up really considering Hawaii at the most because they said, you'll probably start if you come here. So, you know, as a kid, you're like, oh, shoot, yeah. And it's a part of a building a team because they didn't have, we were the first group of recruits. So it was me, a wonderful girl. She's 6'5". Her name is Jeannie Wade. And then this other girl, Connie, she was 6'9". And then we had our point guard, 5'1". It was Daho, Monishin Daho. So we were the first girls recruited for the school for basketball. And when we started, oh, first of all, dad broke down because he wanted me to go see UCLA quietly. He was so sweet. He didn't want to press me, but he was upset when he found out. He was like, shoot. But when we got to the school, our first game, there's only like one set of bleachers, like five rows of people that watched us. By the time and we all started, except Connie, the tall girl, she had problems with her ankles, so she couldn't play too much, but the rest of us started as freshmen. And by the time we were seniors, we had our first NCAA Division I playoff berth, and both the whole gym was full of people. So it was wonderful to be a part of a building team for the University of Hawaii, and they will always be in my heart. I'm in the Alumni Association and stuff where it is wonderful. But that was my college deal. And then when the sweetest thing, which made me feel like I made the right decision, is when UCLA came and played us the first time in Hawaii. I had 18 points and we beat them by, I don't know how, 20 points or something like that. So I was like, yeah. I made the right decision.
Jeez, no, that's amazing. You know, that I really like, you know, building teams and being a part of that. Could you tell us like a little bit of, I guess, like to the day to day, what it was like in the beginning all the way to the end? Was it more competitive? What were the type of players you played with? How did the program kind of shift?
Oh, that's a great answer. When we got there, the one lady that changed my life about posting up, you know, in high school and junior high, I was just a big girl. I was 6'1" by the time I finished playing. So I didn't have to post up really much. You know, everybody was short. And I really didn't understand posting up except just getting the ball and turning it around. Yeah. When I got to Hawaii, the very first person that taught me about posting up, being strong, being wide, was our senior guard. And she was only 5'2". But she knew exactly how a post player should play. And she's the one who taught me the inside moves, the fake outs, you box people, which I love because I was a big girl at that time. I was like Charles Barkley. I was bouncing people out the way and I loved it. So she was teaching me how to use my weight, mm-hmm. which I was happy about because that means I can eat more. So I was like, yeah, you know, bam. So I was a bruiser and I loved it. And I wasn't mean. I just like to move, you know, get my space. But she was the one, she was a catalyst of making me a better player. But they were an excellent teaching program for students, for students and for the players. The coach, he stayed there for a year, then he moved on after his first year. So we got Bill Knepfel, who came from University of San Francisco, where my dad went to school. And he and his wife came and brought us systematically along and kept on improving our game. Our team was a quick team because our point guards are 5'1". Both of them were 5'1", and nobody could catch them. Everybody else's guards were 6 feet, you know, 6'2". They would run circles around them. And so we had a quick game. And then Jeannie, who is 6'5", she was super fast. And so I was a slow one, you know, I was a slow one at the time. But our game was fast and we loved to do our post-ups in the middle because hardly anybody could block us except Ole Miss. Ole Miss was like the one in Long Beach State. They would tear us up sometimes. But, and the girls that we play against, we had like University of Alaska, but always come down, sweet girls that were super nice and their fans were super cool. UOP, University of the Pacific, San Francisco, University of San Francisco. We played in Seattle at one point and we played in Denver. I was out with the surgery that trip. So they played in Utah and Colorado. Another time. Then we played all the way over to Oklahoma and we played at the ORU tournament in Oklahoma and played a lot of kids on this side. So it was really the teams at that time, there weren't that many big teams, big size girl teams like us, but the ones that were Ole Miss, they ran circles around us. Louisiana Tech, Auburn, woo! Those girls were tall and fast. And again, all of them were super kind, great sportsmanship. There was only like one player and one team, which I won't mention. I would love to, but I'm not going to be Scottie Pippen today. Oh. You know, so there was one team that every time we'd play, you know, for a jump ball, for instance, we wouldn't go for the ball. We'd be hitting each other. We'd get the ball. We'd be tripping people, scratching. I was scratching everybody. That was only one team that we did that. After the game, we were fine. But during the game, we just hated each other. And then there was one player on this other team that we weren't too keen about. But she was an awesome player. But we just didn't mesh sportsmanship-wise. But other than that, out of 4 years and all the different teams we played, it was a wonderful experience. And I think every girl should have a sport they can play as a team because to get their camaraderie up, to learn how to help be disciplined for somebody else, you know, and to help each other. And it's just a great experience.
Definitely. You still talk to some of them?
Oh yeah. They're all on my Facebook. Even the volleyball girls. Yes. Wow. Even the volleyball girls. Cause one of the girls, Deetra Collins, that's another thing. When I got there, we all had our jerry curls cause it was the '80s. Right. Mm. So we didn't have to worry about getting our hair wet if you had a jerry curl. So when I got there, people thought I was Deetra Collins, and she was the number one University of Hawaii player for volleyball, and they just won the championship, the NCAA Division I championship the year before I got there. And she went to the Olympics. A lot of her teammates went to the Olympics in 84. And when she finished her 4 years for volleyball, she came and played with us for basketball, and she was awesome. So, but yeah, we talk all the time. She coaches. Now coaches out on the East Coast, and I keep in touch with our football players from the University of Hawaii, our basketball folks, and our volleyball folks, and our sports guys, you know, the guys that we're doing our, even my roommates, I mean, all of them. So yeah, we keep in contact, even my high school folks, Andover and Wild Lake. So I keep in touch with all of them.
All right, so you missed a little, it was 83 to 88, you were at the University of Hawaii, right?
Yes, I played from 83 to 87, and then the last year I just tried to try to ace my chemistry class because I funked it the first time. So I just focused on that. That was the only class I needed to graduate. And I was like, I gotta get this. But yes, those are the years. And again, you know, the another cool thing about being in Hawaii, besides the awesome, beautiful people, the beautiful culture of Hawaii, people just embrace you, especially when you take interest in their culture. That's the number one thing. You don't just go over there and just whatever, I'm here to do, you know, to play. No, you're bringing joy and camaraderie to the culture, to the town. It's like a small town. It's just in the middle of the ocean. And people are so kind. And I learned about the Chinese culture from my friend and her family. I learned about the Filipino culture from my other roommate, and the Samoan culture from another roommate. And it was wonderful. And then of course I had several Hawaiian Chinese roommates and friends from New Zealand and friends from Australia and Guam. And it was such a culturally rich experience that when I came over about racism back here, I was like, well, who cares about racism? There's too many people. There's too many cultures to learn from and grow from. It's very ignorant to be racist and cut off a whole race because you just don't understand them. So that experience, I think, trumps the basketball experience and trumps getting a degree. It was wonderful. Uh-oh. Sorry about my phone ringing.
No worries. You're good. No worries.
That's my sister who woke up from Shang-Chi.
Yeah, I feel like the culture of Hawaii and how it's like kind of a melting pot in the middle of the Pacific of a bunch of different, you know, island cultures and, you know, regions from, like you're saying, like parts of Asia, parts of America, like that's underrated for how much of a melting pot it can be if you go over there, especially for college stuff.
That's wonderful. Awesome. It is fantastic. Yeah.
You missed a little bit of Celtics glory days, though, with those 5 years, that 4 or 5 year stretch there.
Well, the interesting part of that is,
it was a good time.
I may not have been able to go to the games, but I would always see the Celtics in our hotels. We'd stay in the same hotels. Oh. So when Dad would be playing the Lakers, I'd be playing UOP or somebody, and we would come back in the same exact hotel. And same thing when we went to San Francisco, Dad was there. We couldn't That's go, awesome. We were playing the same night, so we just couldn't see each other play. But I got to see them in that respect. And I'll never forget, it was when Bob Cousy would travel with them because he was a commentator at the time. Mm-hmm. So I came back, you know, they would be all in the lobby. When we were in the lobby, all the players, and okay, Dad, have a good game. He goes, yep, you too. All right, see you later. We come back after the game. Dad and Bob Cousy were sitting in the lounge, in the bar lounge. And I come over, hey, Dad. And he said, how'd you do? And I said, and Mr. Cousy goes, yeah, how many points you made? I said, I made 31 points tonight. He said, 31? I said, but they were really short. This particular team, I forgot the name of, it was a small college, and these girls were so cute, but they were itty bitty. So I just literally just, you know, I didn't have to post up. I just stood there. And I said, but they were really small. And he goes, and Bob Cousy was like, who cares how tall they are? You got 31 points. You still, some people don't even get that. I said, you know, that's a good point. But so we got to hang out and see the Celtics that way. And I remember one of the trips during those years, I was talking to Dad. That's when Dad was assistant coach with Bill Fitch. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to Dad. Dad said, do you want to ride back on the bus with us, with the players? I said, oh, yeah, sure. You know, and I'll tell my coach so he knows where I am. We're all going to the airport. And Larry Bird turned around and he goes, you want me to take your bag? And I stared at Larry Bird. He stared at me. I stared at Larry Bird because I was in shock. You know, even though I've known him for a year, you know, since Dad was working with him, it's still Larry Bird. So I just stared at him. And he was very calm. He just, like, waiting for me. And I said, yes, thank you. And he goes, okay. And he put my bag on. I was like, that's Larry Bird. But I was all starstruck, but it was cool. So I did miss it from that sense. Like my brother, he went to Bentley in Waltham. He was there, he can go to the games, but I missed that part. But another interesting thing is in Hawaii, we're like 5 hours behind the East Coast. It's either 4 or 5 hours. So when Dad would be playing the playoffs, like in 84, my hall director at college would get a call from the news station in Hawaii, and they say, get Bryna Jones over there and get her in your room so we can tape her watching her dad, you know, playing the finals. And so he would wake me up at 7 o'clock in the morning. Hurry up, you got to come over because the game will be at 7:30. Yeah. But you guys are watching at 12 or so, you know, at 11:30 or so. So I'd have to get up and I'd look all tore up, you know, because I'm a college student and it's a Sunday morning and I'm laid out. And they would film me watching dad. And then they didn't win and they had another game. They said, okay, well, we'll come back later. I was like, okay. I'm going back to bed. So the one, when they won in 84, I was, again, they called up, hurry up, get a girl up in the, you know, so I was sitting in my friend's dorm room. He was our hall director, Damian Rodriguez. He was sitting up there watching with us. And dad won. And they said, so what did you think about your father winning? And dad was like, hey, Brian, I'm way out there, you know, I love, you know. And I said, this is great. You know, he worked really hard and all this, you know, so I was doing my spiel, you know. Mm-hmm. And then my one of my roommates called me later that day. And she said, my mom saw you on the news today. And she said, what happened to her hair? And I was like, it was 7:30 and I just woke up and I wasn't ready. But anyway, so it was an interesting dynamic during those times.
Ooh, that's incredible. What, any memories from that bus ride? Did Larry proceed to drink 12 beers and not be able to carry the bag at the end of it? Or?
Well, you know what? But those guys, they're so professional and so disciplined and extremely focused that there was no craziness or anything like that. They were just being talk, you know, just talking, have a good time. But I really appreciated their discipline. It made me do that in college. It made me want to be, and I was a calm one in college, you know, because I had other wonderful teammates that were really hyper, you know, yeah, on road trips. I'll just say it that way. But with them, and that's another thing. I miss their calmness and their poise. And when stuff is going down the tubes, you couldn't tell it. They weren't freaking out. They just shifted. They knew how to shift. They knew how to change up. And I think that's because, like, it's like with Dad and Uncle Bill. My brother said that Dad and Uncle Bill would be strategizing when they were in college. They'd be eating lunch and they'd be talking about what they're going to do in the game. And that's how the Celtics to me reminded me of that way. They loved each other, just like Dad and Bob Cousy and Mr. Havlicek and Mr. Heinz and all those guys loved each other. It was the same kind of feeling and same determination of, hey, we're chasing these championships. That's what we're gonna do. So on the bus, they were just very calm and very kind and made sure I had a seat. And they're just always nice. They were always nice to us. And I appreciate that.
Absolutely. No, that's awesome to hear, you know, especially obviously the winning takes care of itself. If, you know, the team is able to always be like that. And that's why you see the consistency, you know, the
yes,
championships in a row. Like that's, you know, we may never see that again.
Yes.
We're praying. Did you, right? Exactly. Hold on to that for as long as you can. Did you have a favorite player at all? And what made him your favorite player?
I did. And Dad poked fun of me every single time I was around him too. And it was Robert Parrish. I had, not only was he my favorite player, I had a crush on him. And I was in high school, junior high at the time. Uh-huh. So every time he'd be back there and Dad would be, you know how dads are sometimes.
Oh yeah.
We'd be walking behind the players, going to the locker room or going someplace and Dad would turn around and tap, you know, Robert Parrish on the back. Hey, Robert, you met my daughter? And I was like, oh, Dad, stop it. You know, but he would do that every single time. But I loved how Robert Parrish was, again, that you couldn't tell he was focused. He wasn't, you know, some players nowadays, not all of them, of course, but there's some players that when they're not doing well or when the game is going not their way, they literally just freak out like a baby almost, you know? And it's like, that's like almost to the point of immaturity. And it's like, that doesn't help anybody. Yeah. That does not help a person. You have to stay focused. You need to figure out what to do the next time down the court to get your team 2 points or 3 points. We don't have time to be yelling at the ref. We don't have time to be yelling at the fan, the freaky fan in the front row. We don't care. We're just focused on getting our team a win. And that's what I loved about Robert Parrish, because you never know. He would just do his thing and go on, you know? And most of the Celtics were just like that. then they were just, they were focused on, hey, this didn't work down there. Let's fix this. If there was a run going on, they knew how to stop it. If they didn't know how to stop it, dad knew how to stop it. He said, oh no, you ain't going to get more than 4 points off of this run. I'm going to call a timeout in a second. But Robert Parrish was my favorite player. Now my favorite person to listen to is Kevin McHale. Cause he'd be talking and talking and you're like, this is exciting. You know, cause he had so many good stories and he was very jovial and very comedic. He was hilarious. He was hilarious. I loved Kevin McHale. And then the sweet one to me was Danny Ainge. Even though this is the time when he was fighting all the time, he would go to dad's hotel room and he'd be coming out the hotel room all the time. And he would come by us and he says, yes, I'm in the hot seat again. Yeah, I messed up again. Or he would say something like that. He was always kind. But dad was just saying, every time you're going there, dad would never tell us what he was talking to him about. He just said, yeah, he's just working through some things. And that's all it was. So I like them all for different reasons. Cedric Maxwell, I loved how he played. I loved how Larry Bird played. I just love Rick Roby, Greg Kite. I loved them all, but Robert Parrish was my number one.
So would you say your least favorite player might be Bill Laimbeer, and you had to break out the Parrish 1-2 someday on a few people?
Well, I wanted to go out there and show him my elbow sometimes, you know? Because, that guy right there was different. He was playing football sometimes, you know, I don't know him personally, but I was like, I can understand playing physically, but he played non-sportsmanlike conduct. That's how he played. I'll put it that way.
Oh yeah. No, he was a pester. That's for sure. The 80s were a bit different. Different then too. You know, stuff that was like not even a suspension is now like a 15-game suspension.
Right. You just get somebody wrong, you get a technical. You're like, man, these guys are weak.
Yeah.
Right. So you played basketball and volleyball in college, and obviously you're balancing school with that too. How did you go about kind of like structuring your day? And did you ever ask somebody like a Danny Ainge, who was also like a three-sport athlete kind of thing, how to balance all this stuff?
See, now if I had sense, I would have done that. But I was talking to another friend of ours. We didn't have the sense to reach out and ask those kind of things. I wish we did, you know, looking back at it. We just kind of suffered through it. Put your head down and, you know. But gratefully and thankfully, the University of Hawaii, our coach, you know, Mr. Bazone and Mr. Nepfo, both coaches were really good at making sure the students were like, hey, you know, you have practice at 3:00. These days, you have to make sure you're in the training room if you need to get your ankles taped or what have you, or treatment by 1:30. That way you'll get there in time for practice and we're going to warm up and blah, blah, blah. And he goes, take your classes in the morning before 12. You can only take these many credits. So they were really good at stretching it for us and getting us set up for success. But I do wish I did ask Mr. Ainge, because he's super cool. I really wish I did, but we were so used to being around players that we didn't want to impose on them. You know, we appreciated them being there, even our uncle, you know, Uncle Bill and them, but we didn't want to impose, and encroach on their time. But I wish I did. I do wish I did.
Nice. What was that like though, in terms of like, what would an average day for you look like, when you got, practices and classes and you got to squeeze in a little skill work or something?
Yes. Okay. So the days were I would have like 2 or 3 classes in a morning, like a Monday. It'd be 2 or 3 classes in the morning before 12. So I'd make sure I get all my notes. I, get to class on time. I had a little moped. Thank the Lord, saved my knees. Get my little moped and get to class. Made sure I got all my assignments and what needed by 12 o'clock. I would pig out to eat because I knew I needed fuel for 3:00. I would kind of take sometimes I would take a nap depending on how early my classes are. Some classes we had to take at 7:30 in the morning, which is crazy for college. But we had to do it for basketball. So if I had an early class, I would take a nap for like 20 minutes so I get ready for practice. And so it was close to practice. I would get down to the gym, make sure I get training, get the trainer to help me. I had a lot of shoulder problems and knees and ankles. So I always had to get taped up someplace or another. The wonderful thing is, while you're getting taped up, sometimes Tom Selleck will walk into the training room. So you got to talk to Manon P.I. while you're getting treated for practice. So that was awesome. Because when he would be doing his show, he also needed attention, for the activities doing the show. Well, the guys' training room didn't have time for him because they had 150 kids in there for football and basketball. So he would come to the women's side because our Melody was our trainer and she always took care of him. So the wonderful thing is, when we were getting our training to get prepared for practice, he would be sitting there and his girlfriend, which is now his wife at the time, it was his girlfriend at the time, but now they're married. They would sit there and talk to us and they were very kind. And we had a great time, and then we'd go right to practice. So for 3 hours, we would get our butts kicked. We would do suicides like there was no other suicides in the world. But we would train really hard, and then we would get our special skills in there after practice. Then around 6 o'clock or so, we're winding down and we would get ready to go to Saga at the time. We didn't have Chick-fil-A and stuff in our at the time, and we had Saga food, and we would get to the, we had to run or ride our mopeds like there was no other to get to the cafeteria before it closed at 6:30. And then the football players would come in and have their training table, which is they would get rid of all the Saga food and bring in all this high class hotel food. And sometimes the football players would sneak us in and we would get the food. But then after we eat dinner, I would literally go home and start go to my room and just start studying. So that was like a normal day. But one thing, every Friday night, we would watch Kung Fu Theater. And that's where I learned at 18, that's where I learned about Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, Tony Leung, Donnie Yen, all these guys. That's when I got my love for martial arts, for sumo wrestling, for Tai Chi and all that kind of stuff. So it was educational in that sense too. I love it.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. And I know you mentioned that, the love of food and everything, and just the ethnic and all the culture in Hawaii. What did you have a favorite dish that you liked, or was there anything that you could recommend? Because I got to take
yes.
it to Hawaii.
That's a great question. And yes, the locomocos are my favorite. One of my favorites. Locomoco is a hamburger patty with a fried egg on top and a bed of rice with brown gravy over it. Oh. And it's delicious. Locomoco. And you can get that. There's certain areas in the States here that have Hawaiian grills or L&L drive-thrus or Aloha grills. I think those are the name of some of the establishments here on the mainland that you can get a locomoco. You can also get one at, get chicken katsu, which is another favorite, which is strips of chicken that are breaded with panko crumbs. And it's nice and crispy. And it's like a big, huge chicken breast. It's huge. On a bed of rice with your macaroni salad and your kimchi. And kimchi is Korean cabbage. And then you always top it off with fruit punch.
Okay.
It's the best. Or, guava juice, something of that nature. But those are my favorite. And then you got manapua, if you need a snack. And manapua is like an adobo, or it's like a steamed or baked roll that has meat inside. So it can have sweet pork inside, or any kind of chicken that they have. It's just delicious.
Jeez. Well, now I'm hungry, so thanks.
Oh, sorry.
No, that sounds so good, and I can't wait to make my trip to Hawaii. Now I know what the first thing I'm gonna eat.
That's, yes.
That's big time.
What did you pick up any Hawaiian kind of, or I guess beach town? I know Maryland's a little cold, so is obviously Massachusetts. Did you dabble in surfing or try that at all while you were out there in the on the island?
No, because ironically, I am aquaphobic. So I went to an island and I'm afraid of water. So I know how to swim. I know I'm an excellent swimmer. But when I was little, I fell into a lake in Massachusetts. And I, you know, that was no big deal until I opened my eyes and saw the fish. And that freaked me out. And so when we would go on boats, I'd just be looking at the water, like, what's under there, you know? And then Jaws didn't help any. I saw it when I was too young. So when I go to Hawaii, it's funny too, when you're practicing or when you're during the season, you can't go to the beach because it drains you, except the girls that live there because they're used to it. So the kids that live in Hawaii, they would go to the beach and boogie board and do all their thing. The rest of us, we'd be, you know, suck the wind and dry it out. So, but when I would go to the beach, I would just wade in the water and just come right back out. Just look at the water. But I only went on one boat trip, a catamaran. And it was supposed to be like a little local love boat kind of a thing. Like you just look at the Waikiki and come back, you know, and I was going with two of my trainers. So, and they were adults, so I felt safe. But we got on the wrong boat and it was a booze cruise. Woo, I was wrong. So that catamaran was full of all these college kids from a different college. It wasn't our college. And they were drunk and they were dancing and one kid got sick. So I was like, this is the wrong boat for me, for an acrophobic person. Yeah. But so for me, I didn't do any surfing or boogie boarding. I just like to wade in the water and just look at the ocean and just look at the beauty that is Hawaii. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's cool. Yeah. We'd love to get out there and do some of that stuff for sure. I'm pretty sure the WNBA was still about a decade from being formed by the time you finished school.
Yeah.
Did you like have any sort of pro aspirations, or were you kind of like, I want to do, you know, the design career thing, like as you started winding down college?
Well, that's a good question too, because when I was the Jeannie, the 6'5" girl, mm-hmm. awesome 6'5" girl, she had a recruiter come and look for her, you know, look at her to play overseas. That's all we had at the time. There was no ABL that came before the WNBA. There was none of that. So it was only overseas was the only option. So she needed us to play with her so they can recruit her. And after we finished playing, this is my senior year, we finished playoffs and everything like that. And the guy approached me and he said, I can guarantee you 30 points a game if you go play overseas. He said, easy. And I was like, I got shoulder surgery in 2 weeks. I'm tired. I said, I had the screw put in this one and I got to put another screw in this one. So I was like, at the time I didn't want to further injure myself and then have to deal with knee surgery later on, which I didn't have to get. I was afraid if I did play, that'd be the next thing to go. Mm-hmm. So I did not go, but if I looking back on it, I wish I asked what country, because as an artist, if he was playing in Paris, I should have said yes. But I wasn't thinking, you know, I was not thinking at the time. But that's one regret that I do have, because it would have been good to embrace another culture and play for someone and play for a town and play with another group of girls and then come home and then recoup. But yeah, I just got my surgery and just stay with volleyball, USVBA volleyball after that.
Nice. How did you hurt your shoulder, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, yeah, no problem. When I was younger, I was always I'm still double jointed, things pop out and I can dislocate everything, hips, knees, kneecaps, shoulders. So I would always do, I was like a party trick. Yay, look at I could do this. Well, my freshman year, 8 games into it, one girl yanked my arm out and it never hurt when it dislocated. So, but it just yanked out and I was like, oh, you know, it yanked and it pops right back in. And then I started I was saying hi to a friend of mine and it dislocated and went back in. So I was like, usually I can control it. Well, I couldn't control it anymore. So I would lift my arm up just doing this, it would pop in and pop out. So I told the trainer, she said, you know, if you keep doing that, it can sever the nerve in your arm and then you lose the use of your arm. So I said, I'll take care of it now. So they they gave me the, it's called the Bristow procedure, where they put a screw about this long and they, you know, get surgery, they screw it in your shoulder. And you usually are out for the season, but I was praying hard because I didn't want to lose, you know, miss out on my freshman year. I only played like 10 or 11 games or something so far. So thankfully to the Lord, I was able to play after a month and a half after surgery. It usually takes 4 months to recover. I recovered in a month and a half.
Wow.
So my trainer was like freaked out, but she said, yep, if you can touch the ceiling, you're fine. So I was able to touch the ceiling, nothing popped open, okay. So I played the rest of my freshman year. And then by the time I finished finishing up my senior year, my other shoulder started dislocating without me controlling it. So I said, just, this one was hurting more. So they just dealt with the pain and until my last couple of games. And then after that, I had my surgery. So that's what it was.
So I had something similar to that too. And that's what ended up, I stopped playing with the same type of reason. And I had like 4 different surgeries on my shoulders. So it's, I understand that type of
yes.
yes. Just kind of the up and down ride of like, you never know if it's going to be okay or whatever. So I understand and can see.
You can feel that? Did you have the screws in there too?
Yeah, and I got the orthoscopic first, and then I re-tore it, so then they had to open me up and then put it in. So it was like a bunch of different things happened with it. But yeah, like the shoulders and knees are the, and I guess head injuries are the toughest to, I think I got back from playing wise. So
yeah, well, I got kicked in the head. Phew. I got kicked in the head during practice once.
You ran into a Bill Laimbeer on your own team?
Oh, I tell you, it was one of those drills that we never did again after that.
Yeah.
It was like a ball in the middle of the court, and we had girls on both sides and said, dive for the ball and take it to your, you know. Well, I dove for the ball. The other girl got it, and she went up to run, and my head was in between her legs. Pop!
Oh.
So I was out for a day, but that's all right.
We used to call that one steal the bacon at the camp I worked at. That's funny.
Oh, that's the way to go.
Yeah, no, that's great. So you finished kind of your basketball career and you moved on into kind of a professional life. Mm-hmm. What, where did you start? You know, walk us through kind of your rise up the ladder to, you know, eventually, you know, being a administrator or a manager of design, and then, you know, starting your own firm eventually as well.
Oh, sure. Well, when I got out of school, I went straight to Dallas because that's where all my siblings were. And I couldn't afford to live in Hawaii. And I didn't have the sense, again, to ask Dad, you can afford it. Can you pay for me to stay here until I get a job? But I didn't think about that. So I came to Dallas. And in the 80s, the big thing at the time was painting T-shirts, hand painting T-shirts. So they were doing designs, but they needed an artist to sit out in a jewelry store, you know, to drum up more business. And most of the artists are very shy or very, you know, quiet. I'm the opposite, as you can see. So I was like, yeah, bring me out there. So I would sit up there and paint and do whatever. And then one person said, can you paint Albie Shore? Who's a singer at the time. Can you paint Albie Shore on a sweatshirt? I said, sure. So I painted him. Oh, can you paint my dog? Sure. So I was painting all these, you know, then I got so overwhelmed with orders, I had to go someplace and finish them. But so that was my first professional job. And then after that, I did the normal freak out artist thing, was I'm never going to get a professional job as an artist. So I'm going to go into something normal in business. So I went to medical records and medical billing and all that kind of stuff. And one of my friends, who's still my friend today, Miss Ann Diltz, she looked at me and she said, you should not be here. You should be in corporate America. And I said, well, how do I get there? So she was mentoring me with billing and billing and coding and all the good stuff. And I just had, I had the opportunity to go to Chicago. Well, really, I was chasing a dude. That's the real thing. I was chasing this dude that was in Chicago. So I said, well, let me go over there. And when I got there, of course, that didn't work out. My brother said, you go get a job. You go to a agency, a temp agency, and sign up. So I went up there. I signed up for like 9 agencies. One called me back in a couple of days. And when I got there, they said, oh, Kraft Foods wants to talk to you in 10 minutes. I was like, oh, okay. And when I got there, the young lady at HR, when she was talking to me, I told her about my art in Hawaii and all kind of stuff. And she said, you sound like you should be in ethnic marketing. Because she goes, we have two positions open, one for marketing administrative assistant and one for ethnic marketing administrative assistant. And they do more creative stuff over there. And so she offered me the job for that position. And that's how I got into Kraft Foods as an admin. And I'd never been an admin. It was just all based on, they said, we're all about, at the time, this is before they got bought out by Heinz. They said, we're all about 80% personality, 20% skill. We can teach you the skill. That's not a problem. But if you have a bad attitude, we don't want you. And which is a good thing. So it was a wonderful place to work. And they were really serious because there was somebody that had a really bad attitude. They were an intern, they got hired, and then they treated a person that was their senior. This guy was there for like 25 years and he was like a really high up. And this little kid came in and started acting disrespectful to this person in a meeting. That person was gone within a week. I was like, wow. So they're really into preserving a really good culture at that time, a really good culture of teamwork, camaraderie. And they had a lot of college athletes and a lot of military that worked there. So we had a lot of, and they said that's what they look for because you know how to work as a team. So that's my start into corporate America. And one of the young ladies, Andrea Brown, she worked with one of my bosses and she got promoted to the pizza division. That's DiGiorno, Tombstone, that's when they had it at the time. Now Nestle has it, but at the time Kraft had it. And she got promoted and she asked me to come follow her as a project manager for design. And that's how I started.
That's amazing. That's too cool. Did you have a favorite like design project that you worked on while you were there?
Yes, it was Project Slacker. They name stuff different, you know, they would just name, because, you know, it's easier to remember a project name than a number. Project 125, you know, I'm never gonna remember that. Yeah. But if you name it, it was about, DiGiorno had a project, it was years ago, and it was successful. They did it like 2 or 3 years in a row. And they said, we're gonna pay you to be our delivery boy. And since you do it at home, you don't have to do anything because we don't need a delivery boy. So we'll pay you for doing nothing. So that's why we called it Slacker. And it was awesome. And our design firm did a wonderful job of transforming the DiGiorno pizza box into all these dollar bills. You didn't even see the pizza. It was just dollar bills all stuffed on the pizza box. And that was my favorite one because I love the promotion for it, the actor that they used for the commercial, and I just loved how the design came about.
That's awesome. That's cool. Yeah. Do you still paint?
I still paint. Right now I'm learning more computer graphics, like with Photoshop and Illustrator, mm-hmm. because they didn't have that when I was in college. We had a terminal. We didn't even have a personal PC. But I do paint. One of my paintings is in a Racine, Wisconsin gallery. Oh, wow. They had three pieces and two of them sold right away because they were abstract. But the one that in there is braid, so it's a person's profile. But yeah, I still paint and I draw. I do a lot of drawing, coloring. But yeah, I love it.
Wow. Sorry, go ahead, Mike.
No, you're good, man.
I was just wondering if you got any like projects or any artwork that you're working on now.
Right now we're building Dad's foundation. But I will be doing artwork for the foundation because I want to do some artwork of Dad, because ironically, I never done anything for Dad. I've done it for everybody else, but I never painted Dad or I never did any graphics of Dad. So I would like to do that and bring the black and white thing into now. Because, you know, all the cool graphics, the graffiti type of graphics, or those, like Michael Jordan has awesome paintings of him from different artists, you know. And I would like to do that for Dad, you know what I mean? Because a lot of, and for Bob Cousy and for Tommy Heinsohn, you know, for the folks of that era, so kids can try to bridge that gap that they're sadly mistaken, that they think that those guys aren't as strong as the guys now. I said, they were eat their lunch and pop the bag if they play. Oh no, y'all. Mm-mm. And they were playing with under so much oppression for, you know, cultural oppression and all this other stuff that was going on. Kids nowadays wouldn't even handle the pressure of the criticism that they had to go through.
Yeah.
They would fold like a blanket, you know? So I would like to do art that way to bridge that gap and to educate kids. I said, don't judge those folks from the 50s and 60s and compare them to who you think is a better player now, because you weren't there, first of all. Second of all, you didn't see the tapes, which you need to watch. Third of all, I can go on down the line on that one. But so I would like to do artwork in that regard, open up a conversation so they can learn from it. I mean, again, like when people say, oh, this guy's breaking ankles. Bob Cousy, if you look at his tapes, he was breaking everybody's ankles before they even knew what breaking ankles were. So, and look, Uncle Bill was jumping over a person to do a layup. Didn't touch the man, cleared him. So you can't tell me. Anyway, so I went off on a tangent. But anyway. Nah. That's the kind of artwork awesome. I like to do. Yeah.
What's your medium? Are you more watercolors or oil or acrylic?
I love oil, because oil, nice. You can make a mistake and wipe it off. With watercolor, you're stuck with it. Same thing with acrylics. You're stuck. So I like oil is my favorite. And I love the awesome. Richness of it.
The texture. Yeah, I'm a big fan of oil, and like all the, you know, old oil guys like Van Gogh, Monet, that stuff's.
Yeah.
That stuff pops.
Oh, it's fantastic. Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. So you went through, you know, a pretty illustrious kind of design career, going to JCPenney and then PepsiCo after Kraft. What kind of made you decide to kind of go off on your own and transition into your own firm? And where can people kind of check out, you know, what you do?
Oh, that's a good question. I have to make one of those. Right now I do not have one, but I'll make something so people can see what I've done in the past. Bryna Lynn Studios, and my name is Bryna, but I go by Brenna. No, that's okay. I go by anything. Brenna. I answer to it all. My nickname is Brenna Lynn from my parents, but my real name is Bryna. But my high school track coach got me out. He would call me Bree. And I said, you know, so after a couple of weeks, I said, you know, my name is Brian, it's not Bree. He goes, Bree, Bri, bro, who cares? Just, you know, Bree, come over here. So after that, I was like, okay. It didn't bother me at all. So whatever you call me is totally fine. So don't worry about it. It's all good.
I probably should have asked that at the beginning of the
podcast. No, that's okay. I said, my parents call me Brenna, so, and my name is Brian, so it's okay.
It's that's
really
funny.
But so Brenna Lynn Studios started because I wanted to do side projects while I was doing the corporate stuff. The corporate stuff, I'm the project manager for the designers. So I'd help get them what they need. I would help the brand folks interpret their marketing objectives into design objectives, so our design would meet their marketing needs. So I would do that kind of thing, but I never got a chance to really do artwork except when I was in ethnic marketing. I would do like little side projects for grassroots projects. And like for Cheech and Chong, I got to do Cheech's, his little personal Alma Awards invitation. I got to do that. Yay, you know, and that was just for his family and stuff like that. So that kind of a thing I'd love doing. But so Bryna Lynn Studios or Bryna Lynn Studios came forward so I can do some side stuff. And so people just, you know, email me and say, hey, or those are my friends that knew me at the time. And they would say, hey, I need this for my kid, or can you draw me a picture of their dog, or paint this? And so I would do it. So I just opened up that little firm for doing things for friends. But once I get dad's foundation going, I will have a little section for artwork, and I'll make sure I send you. I do have a little contact sheet from when I was in Chicago doing more artwork, and I'll send you that so you guys can post it. Yes. But yeah.
Very nice. No, and you know, I know you're talking a little bit about the foundation for your dad. Would you be able to kind of talk a little bit about that? And I read a little bit about, you know, kind of who you're trying to help and things of that nature.
Oh yes, yeah, sure. Okay, so for dad's foundation, again, we were raised not to really talk about who our father was, so people didn't know until they asked us. So we weren't used to saying we weren't really used to being coming forth with, oh yeah, our dad's Casey Jones, I want to do this. Or we never were raised that way. So, but a couple of us always wanted to do a foundation for dad, but we were so quiet about it. We were like, hey, never went through it until like the last year of his Alzheimer's, when he's going through Alzheimer's. I was talking to a friend of mine, Ned Walworth, who owns Amalgam design firm. It's a marketing and design firm and an advertising agency. And I said, I want to do something for dad's, for dad. I want to do a foundation for dad. He goes, hey, I'm all in. He said, whatever you want to do, I'm there. So when dad started progressing and I was getting back in touch with my brother and stuff like that, and he wanted to do the same thing, that when dad passed, he was like, this is the best time to do it, you know, let's jump on it. And there were so many things that I did not know about dad until after he passed, because he was so quiet. People say, oh, he's quiet on the court. Well, he was quiet at home too. The only time he was loud is when dad went to Puerto Rico and had that 3 months of, you know, teaching those, it was a summer league out there in Puerto Rico. Those guys were awesome. Those players were fantastic. And their families are super nice. But we were playing, he was sleeping in the apartment, in the condo facing the ocean. And it's really windy up there. We ran through that room. You know, we came out from outside. So he was sleeping. We didn't care. We ran through that room. And I was the last kid and the door slammed. And he all we heard, rah, 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 rah. That's the loudest I've ever heard dad yell or bark or whatever sound he was making. He never made that sound on the court. But he was, he sat up and me fell out laughing. He went right back to sleep too. He didn't even remember he did it. That's as loud as he's ever been at home. Other than that, he was super quiet. He would, when he got inducted to the Hall of Fame for the Bay Area, I did not know. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in front. I was going back from Hawaii for a road trip. I was sitting in front of a statue. And I said, this guy looks familiar. Who is this guy? It was dad. I called him up. I said, dad, what the world is going on? He said, oh, you'll find out eventually. That's dad. So we were the same way. We were like, you know, we didn't say much. But when he passed, we're like, we want people to know how dad was as a person, what he was like at home, and how was it like to be a kid of somebody in the NBA? Because you don't think about, and again, this is the root of where the foundation comes. Most kids don't think about, you know, oh, it'd be cool if your dad was in the NBA and this and that. We thought it was cool if your dad was home every day at 5 o'clock. We missed him. We didn't see him for weeks at a time. Or we would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day, open up our presents by 6, and he had to go to the game. Or same thing with Valentine's Day, same things with Thanksgiving, Easter, you know, so we were happy about other kids' fathers coming home at a normal time. And those kids were happy about us because we would go to the games and stuff. So we wanted people to know dad in that fashion and to know what it's like to be in the, you know, part of the family of the NBA. We had to sit there at away games and hear people cuss our father out. And we couldn't say nothing. You wanted to go, you know, yeah. You wanted to pop them, but you know, it's nothing personal, but you have to deal with that. And a lot of kids or people don't understand that side of the NBA mm-hmm. from the family point of view, mm-hmm. you know? So the foundation came that we wanted to show people and share with folks dad. And dad would be if he didn't have Alzheimer's, he would be doing the same thing. He loved to talk to people about basketball, about life, share his rings. He would give people his rings and let them look at it and hold it and take pictures of it. Because it was a part of, it's just who he was, and he loved the experience. So that's where it came from. And then when I started posting more about dad, I was always posting on Twitter about my TV shows and Mandalorian, all psych and everything. When I started posting about dad, all these people were coming out. Your father taught me basketball when he went to this camp. I met your father at a golf tournament. I met your father, Ronnie Lott, of all people. He said, your father changed my career when I saw how he conducted himself. I was like, wow, because I love football. So I was like, wow. And you know what I mean? So all these people came out of the woodwork and started sharing their experiences with dad. And we were like, we have to do something. So, and we're going to help. We want to help. Dad wasn't recruited for college. when he finished, he was like his number, he was like the best commerce. He went to a commerce high school in San Francisco, and he was the best basketball player and football player, but he was not recruited. Back in those, you know, it's the 50s. Back in those days, you know, there was not that many folks of color being recruited. And one of their journalists, it was a sports reporter, he contacted dad and said, "What school are you going to?" He said, "I'm not going to school." He said, "My mom's on welfare. I'm going to go to the post office. I'm going to work at the post office." And that guy said, "Oh, no, you're not." He said, "Look at my news article tomorrow morning." And dad said, "Okay." Dad said, he got that newspaper. And it said, "Casey Jones being recruited by USC, UCLA, such and such and such." He made all these schools like dad was going to be recruited, and he was not. But because of that article, schools started calling him. And one of the schools is University of San Francisco. And they said, "Would you consider playing for our team?" And he said, "I got to get my mom off of welfare." His mom and dad divorced when he was 9, but they couldn't afford to get divorced. You know, they just lived separately. They couldn't afford to, you know. So he said, "I'm trying to get them off of welfare." The school said, "If we give your mom a job, would you come play for us?" He goes, "Oh, okay." And his mom was like, "Yeah." So they put her as housekeeping in the number one hotel, the Fairmount Hotel in San Francisco. Put her there to work, and she loved it. And dad was happy, and dad was able to play. So we want to do that for other kids that don't have the opportunity, who may not be getting all the scholarship, you know, opportunities thrown at them. And we want to educate kids, and we want to also educate folks on the Black Five, you know, the Negro League. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because dad was inducted into the Hall of Fame with Pop Gates, who was part of the Negro League. And I didn't understand that there was a foundation for the Black Five, for the starting five or the Black Fives. And they have gear to celebrate those players and everything, and a website. They're awesome. So we want to bring them. We want to bring awareness to them. We want to bring awareness to the young lady from, I think it was Sweet Blackberries. I think that's the name of the site. If not, I'll make sure I text it to you. She was Hillary on The Fresh Prince. Mm-hmm. And she has a foundation that brings animated stories of Black inventors, Black sports people, people in the news to schools, to elementary school kids and to junior high kids to show all of history. So we want to bring, you know, light to that. We want to bring light to University of Hawaii, because a lot of people forget about the folks way out there, and to see the cultures that they had wanted to coach for University of Hawaii, but he was so quiet, he didn't tell anybody until after. So, you know, so we want to bring that. We want to bring a Kingdom Performance, who is a company in Dallas that teaches kids who are disabled, who have mental challenges. They teach kids basketball, and the parents love it because the kids are losing weight. They're getting in shape.
Yeah.
They also teach regular kids how to get scholarships and how to be a team player. And then also we want to support Penny Hardaway's foundation in Memphis that he helps kids out there as well. So those are the as my brother said, like the starting five of the first groups that we want to help out with the foundation once we get it up and running. So we're working on a podcast now for it. So we're shopping around for a host. And we know what host we want. So I'm waiting for the guy to be asked. Nice. I'll tell you guys as soon as we know.
Awesome.
Yeah, definitely keep us posted. I mean, mm-hmm. I think, you know, like you're saying, like the bringing the attention to your dad's story and like, you know, it's super humble guy. I think that's, you know, partially why like there isn't a big documentary on him. I mean, little did he know he was going to University of San Francisco and was going to hang out with Uncle Bill for the next like 50 years. Like a Netflix funny. Netflix needs to get the Bill and Casey documentary going. Like yes. that would be an unreal story.
I agree.
And you know, I think, you know, the humility and the principles that he lived by were, you know, everyone should can learn from for sure. Yeah. how do people get involved? I know, like you're saying, it's kind of still getting rolling. Is there mm-hmm. like a way to get involved yet with the Casey Jones Foundation, or is there like a scholarship that kids can apply for yet? Or
we don't have that established yet. Once we get the podcast going, then we'll have we're hoping to get finances through that, and through mm-hmm. selling of his shirts, we were able to raise $1,000 for the Casey Jones shooting shirts that we sold earlier this year. But it took all of that money to ship the stuff out because we didn't know what we were doing at the time. So we like double packed stuff and it sucked up like all the money. But so we owe University of San Francisco $1,000 because that's how much we put aside from people giving into that foundation. But once we get the finances and digitize all of his tapes, we have his practice tapes from the 87 Boston Celtics. We got all that stuff. Wow. So we want to share that with everybody. We have practices from the 86 Celtics and all that kind of stuff. So we have to pour money into that first so we can set up for the scholarships. But if you want to be involved, you can always email me at caseyjonesfoundation@gmail.com or brynalynnstudios@gmail.com. Or you can tweet me, Becoming Bryna. The reason why I'm Becoming Bryna, because I went through a really dark period and I didn't know who I was. So now I know who I am. So that's why it's called Becoming Bryna, because I was like, I'm becoming who I'm supposed to be. So anyway, just so they can tweet me there. They can follow me on Instagram. It's the same, Becoming Bryna. And that's awesome. They can reach out.
Yeah, no, it's great to see. Like you said, I can't imagine the pressures and, you know, all the different angles of growing up as, like you were saying, like your dad's not around, but everyone's like, oh, like, that's so cool. And it's like, well, it'd be really cool if we made it to dinner. And like that, those kind of pressures and balancing that, like, obviously he was an amazing father. Like the, you know, that's something that people don't always think of with the angles. You know, we watch Deuce Tatum mm-hmm. run around on the court every day and we're all yeah. loving it, but you know, yeah. the pressure and the, you know, the family dynamic at home, like, can be a different thing. So that's very cool yeah. to see, you know, you guys keeping the memory going. And I mean, he's all time great coach, one of the greatest 75 players of all time. I believe he was on that list, wasn't he?
He wasn't on that list either. No, he wasn't on the list, but Uncle Sam was. Uncle Sam was. He didn't have the point. And he wasn't like an all-star at the time. He did all the defensive work. So that's what he was known for. So
he was Marcus Smart. No. A little better.
Yeah. It's the folks that do the work. I mean, like Dennis Rodman. He was rebounding, doing defense. He was doing all that stuff that nobody else would want to do. Excellent. So, and he's an awesome, that's another person I forgot. Dad always wanted to talk to Rodman and get a hold of him. Mm-hmm. He always wanted to work with him. He loved him that much from afar. Because Dad's so quiet, he didn't go to him and say, hey, can I talk to you? That's too quiet.
So funny. He's such a different, you know, personality type too. For your dad to be like, oh man, I really like that Rodman guy, I would think, like, you know, your dad would be like, that Rodman guy needs to turn it down a bit.
He loved him. He loved him. And I said, just talk to him. But Dad, he was quiet like that. He wouldn't go out there and say, hey, you know, like, did you know that Dad was on the Oprah Winfrey show?
No. When was he on Oprah?
It was years. It was like, I was in Chicago at the time. And my sister, before she works for Michael Jordan, but before she worked for him, she worked for people connected to Stedman, Stedman Graham. So she would always get tickets to go to the Oprah Winfrey show to be in the audience because they needed people in the audience. And, you know, so she was sitting there and the people for the show said, are there any children of divorce here? Because we're going to do a segment for children of divorce, adult children of divorce. And she goes, yeah, my parents got divorced when we were in high school and in junior high. We're all at different ages, but she was in high school at the time. And she goes, okay. And so they got like 6 or 7 people out of the audience from that day instead of doing the show for the next day. So the first section of it, or the first day, it was all about the children, and they would say how they described it when their parents left and this and that and da 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 da. And they said the next day, they said, can you ask your parents to come and share their side of the story with you? And my sister asked Dad, and he said, yeah, I'll be there. So he came and they were the first guests. I wish I gotta find the tape. I don't know who has the tape, but they were the first guest and I was in the audience. So I remember sitting in the audience and they had a camera on me. I was like, ah, but they're really smart, you know? So Dad and Leslie were up there, my sister Leslie, and they started rolling the tape of the background. Casey Jones, and they didn't say anything about Dad being a basketball coach because it wasn't about that. It was about him being a father and divorced the mother. Mm-hmm. So when they showed all the home pictures of our family life, I started bawling. I was like, somebody ripped up my heart open again. And Oprah was like, looking at me like, what's going on over there? And so they would show pictures and stuff like that. And then they started talking to Dad and Leslie. And Oprah was really good. I loved how she did it. She was saying, how do you feel? She goes, your father left you, didn't he? And she goes, he goes, yeah. He said, but how do you feel when you left your own daughter the way your father left you? And he was, Dad was like, whoa, you know, shoot. But it made him think, because he was busy. He had things going on, and he had, you know, that was his rough time that he was going through. So, but she did a great job. I loved how she did it. And then she saw me still bawling, and she asked me, she goes, you're the sister. What's going on over there? I said, I thought I was over it, but I'm 36 years old and I'm not over their divorce. And that hit my dad too. And so then after that, she thanked them. And then they sat down next to me, mom, dad, and Leslie, and she had the next guest come up. So when they were getting ready for the commercial, this gentleman came and shook Dad's hand, and he goes, I was with your sister during this, you know, adult children of divorce, but my father wouldn't come for me. So I want to thank you for being here for your daughter. And Dad cried. I've never seen Dad cry ever, ever. Even when they got lost by the Lakers, I never seen him cry. That was the only time I seen him cry.
That's awesome.
So we want to bring that to it, because that people go for that too, no matter if you're NBA or not.
That's
so
real.
We want to bring that stuff to for people too.
Definitely. No, I really like that. You know, it just brings the whole, like, brings it back to, you know, Dad's a person, you know, and as successful as he was, he's a person first, and he's your father first, you know. So that's, I really love that story, you know, and what the foundation is about. And like, I obviously, I mean, on my end can't do much, but I would, like, if there's anything I could ever do, I'd love to help and be a part of something. I have a small mentor group for kids that I, you know, like to, you know, just provide them with somebody that's in the field that they have planned to work in eventually. And so that they can reach out to them and have questions. So I love projects like this, and this is also exciting. I love that, you know, people are working together to help, you know, people that are a little bit less fortunate. So that's
very true.
Exciting. And I can't wait to hear what you guys do with this.
Really, we'll keep you guys in contact, and we'll help out with kids in the corporate world, because my brother was also in the corporate world as well. Oh. So, I mean, and my sister, I have one sister in the airline industry, mm-hmm. another sister in the college industry. Oh, wow. And then I was in corporate America, and my brother's in hotel industry and hospitality. So yeah, we would love to help kids.
Oh, that's
totally. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Definitely gives another layer to the Casey Jones legend. You know, that speaks volumes to the type of you know, guy and dad that he was, in terms of, you know, breaking down in that moment of all moments. Like, you know, he unbelievable dude. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. But definitely keep us posted. Maybe once you know, we got the website live and stuff, we got somewhere people can donate, you can come back on, talk some hoops, and plug the old foundation, maybe get a kid to apply for a scholarship. That'd be cool.
I would definitely do that. And then also we'll bring my brother on, because he has all the players and the, because he played with the Celtics during like camps, summer camps and stuff. He was 18.
Yeah.
So we're going to get him on this. You guys can talk to him, because he knows all of those inside stories.
He might have saw a different side of the fellows. They might have let their guard down a little bit more around the daughter of the coach. They're on their best behavior now.
They treat him just like everybody else, because he said he remembered Greg Kiba, but punish him bad, you know. But they're best friends, you know. Mr. Kite is awesome. But oh yeah, they played hard out there.
That's awesome. That's cool. Yeah. So anything else you got going on, or anything else you want to talk about today?
Well, I think that's it, but if anything comes up, just have us back on. We'll come on anytime.
Will do.
We appreciate it.
Yes, cool. It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for, you know, answering the DMs of a couple of goobers who run a podcast. So we're always happy to talk to people. And like I said, you're the Duchess of the House of Jones and the Celtics royal family. So it's quite an honor to, you know, to finally meet you. I know we had our scheduling issue the last few weeks, so we appreciate the patience. I saw your Halloween costumes looked great. So it was cool you guys had some fun.
Yes, but it was fun.
Awesome.
And my sister was bad in that. My sister with the basketball.
Yeah.
She was being bad. Oh, that's classic. She was in the Celtics jacket and everything.
That was his Hall of Fame ball. And that was his jersey. Man. Yeah, the stuff that he'd work out in.
That's amazing. That's too cool. Well, I really appreciate your time here on this Sunday, Brian. And, we'll have to get together again soon. So
definitely. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And, look forward to getting to know you a little bit better as well. So
awesome. And you guys got my contact information. So I look forward to hearing from you.
For sure.
Oh, yeah.
And get those locomocos.
No, I'm going to take a picture of it, or might be a video of like how I'm eating this thing. Because I'm guessing it's going to be amazing. So
it's delicious.
Video is coming.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. That was cool. That was really cool.